do I want that done to you? Like, that gets really practical really quickly when you start talking about investigations and processes and procedures and complaints or accusations. Like, what does do unto others as you would have them do unto you look like?
Welcome to the Stand Firm podcast. We are recording this episode on Tuesday, May 19th, 2026. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm hosting alone today. Neither Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, nor J.D. Koch of Holy Trinity Parish in Hillsdale, Michigan, are able to be here this week. However, in their stead, I have a guest. I'm joined now by the Reverend Elijah Lovejoy, Rector of the Anglican Church of the Resurrection in Hope Mills, North Carolina. Elijah, welcome to Stand Firm.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you, Nick. I'm an assistant baseball coach, so I feel like I could say maybe I'm pinch hitting for JD and Matt. If y'all will allow me to be a pinch hitter today, I'd appreciate that.
Praise the Lord. So as our listener likely knows, the ACNA has been engaged in a long process of revising our Title IV canons, that is, our rules and regulations around safeguarding and discipline. And in the wake of the Stuart Ruck trial, this was seen, I think, province-wide as a non-negotiable. Now, you have been looking under the hood of these revisions a bit, and even though there is a final draft that has been put forward for ratification at Provincial Assembly later this summer, you're not sure the work is really finished. Now, you've been, like I said, observing and commenting on this process for a long time. How did you get involved in it in the first place?
Yeah, that's a great question. I appreciate the interest. I'll start a bit more abstract and then get more concrete. Might sound like a cliche, but the biggest reason is I love Jesus's church, and I love the health of the church and want the church to be healthy. And as I've kind of surveyed this issue across multiple denominations, sometimes we can only be focused on ourselves, but this is actually an issue across multiple denominations right now. I didn't realize that till I started looking into it, but this has been a major issue for the Roman Catholic Church, to the point that the Catholic University of America did the largest study in 50 years of Roman Catholic priests to kind of examine the health of a disciplinary relationship between bishops and clergy in particular. I talked to a Presbyterian church pastor, and I said, is this an issue in the Presbyterian church? He said, sure enough, yeah, this is a big issue. Same for ACNA, obviously. We're doing a province-wide effort. And then the Episcopal Church, they've had some news stories come out recently about difficult Title IV situations. So that would be kind of the first just interest in how can this be. This is obviously an important issue across the Church of Christ today. So that interests me. Second, I love the Anglican Church, and especially the interconnectedness of the Anglican Church with bishops and clergy and laity. And I've thought a lot about Jesus's command, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And as Anglicans, we don't have to look far to find the others. We're surrounded by the others. We have bishops above us and laity that we are entrusted with shepherding, and vice versa. Like, there's others all around us. And so Title IV is both it's a real issue, but it's also a very practical issue. What would I want done to me if I were in this situation, and do I want that done to you? Like, that gets really practical really quickly when you start talking about investigations and processes and procedures and complaints or accusations. Like, what does do unto others as you would have them do unto you look like? So that's the abstract. To get more concrete, I began hearing a number of years ago kind of a number of stories of either misconduct or unjust, what I would call unjust disciplinary processes across multiple dioceses, and such a way that it affected laity, friends that I knew in the laity, it affected clergy, friends I knew in the clergy, and it has affected bishops. And nobody has a monopoly on misconduct, and nobody has a monopoly on being unjustly treated. It can happen, strange as it might sound, it can happen across the board. The sinful nature affects everyone and everybody. And everybody needs to be treated justly and fairly and with the love of Christ. And so I ended up being entrusted by a College of Presbyters group. I don't speak for the College of Presbyters, but I was tasked with leading a group that looked into this issue in particular. How did a process of investigation, a complaint, an investigation unfold?
Just for
And
clarity's sake, this is the College of Presbyters in the Diocese of Christ Our Hope.
correct, Greg. So we were doing a deep dive on this before the province ever announced that they were going to revamp the whole canon. So over a year ago, we were doing a deep dive on this. We didn't know, hadn't been kind of, the public feedback hadn't, the process hadn't begun. So we were doing our own deep dive, or as you saw, described it, kind of looking under the hood, conducting interviews, a number of interviews of clergy who'd been through the process of, we call it being accused from below. Or, and then investigated from above. And in almost every case that we interviewed, the clergy remained in good standing. Again, this is we've looked at this across multiple dioceses now. There was no a canonical violation and no formal discipline was given. And yet they still encountered what was very difficult circumstances, sometimes the loss of a job, sometimes the loss of income, legal fees incurred, family and emotional health impacted, church health impacted, reputation on the line, and trust broken and lost. Again, across multiple dioceses, we've encountered this. And so that kind of created the question, how could these processes become more fair, more just? Yes, discipline does need to happen. Yes, people do need to be protected, but it needs to be done in a fair and equitable and a way that everybody understands the process, which is actually one of the goals of the governance task force. So I know that's kind of a long answer, but it's been quite a while examining these issues. I've since read all the Episcopal Church canons on this, the Roman Catholic Church essential norms on this. I've kind of done a comparative analysis as well.
So would you agree, would you and the team that was working with you agree that the ACNA's Title IV, as they existed previously, were in need of revision?
Yeah, absolutely. We're in total agreement on that. I know some people say, why did it need to be reformed? I think there's a lot of good reasons it needed to be reformed, and I'd say that the GTF overall has done a great job. From my perspective, they're a good 75% of the way along to where we need to be. There's a little bit that needs to be done to get across the finish line, which is why our article, Good But Not Finished, is a lot of great work. So why did this need to be reformed? Number one, there was just a lack of detail in the old canons and a lot of confusion about the process. I'll give you an example. Again, across multiple dioceses. So this isn't a one-off. This isn't a bug. Multiple clergy were accused and investigated without knowing what they were accused of. That happened across multiple So how do you respond to an accusation if you don't
And there wasn't
know?
anything in the canon itself that would have prevented that.
I don't know. Yeah, I won't say that. There may have been. It's just that you have this kind of, you're notified, you've been accused, and you're now under investigation. But can I know what I'm accused of? I'm sorry, we can't tell you that. And oftentimes, the thought would be that there's a good reason for that. Maybe it would compromise the identity of the complainant, so that needs to be protected. But it's very difficult, especially if this isn't something of a criminal nature or a prosecutable nature in terms of like a crime, to know how to respond to that. And so the new canons solve that problem. They say you have the right to know a fair synopsis of the allegations against you. You also have a right now to know the nature of the evidence that is supporting the complaint against you or the report against you. So that's a great improvement. That's a really good improvement all the way around. Too difficult to make a report is another complaint about the old canons, or too difficult to actually take action. I think at one point in time where the old canons say you had to have 10 witnesses or 10 reporting parties to even kind of get a hearing, and then that was going to go to a presentment, for example, against the
Famously
bishop.
in the Wood case, yeah.
Yeah, and so I compare that to, it's like threading a needle. The old canons are like trying to get a thread through the eye of a needle. Very, very difficult. I would compare the new cannons to a funnel. So the new cannons are designed to take in as many. In fact, there's a guaranteed right to file a report in the new cannon. So it's going to be like a funnel that anybody and everybody can file a report. That's guaranteed in the cannons. And so the cannons are designed to slowly process that report and to kind of gauge it, to winnow it, to examine it. Ken and Andrew Rowell has done a great job of talking about we're looking for the truth here. What's the truth of the matter? So the question becomes, as that funnel narrows and narrows and narrows, do people understand that process? Do they have equal rights in that process? Do they have are they going to be treated fairly in that process? That's one of our concerns, is about fairness. And so that's a good thing to it's going to become, I would say, more of a sensitive instrument. So if you get one complaint against you in 10 years, like, and it wasn't like a sexual or criminal or a financial nature, probably safe to say that's not a consistent pattern of behavior in your character. But if you have 10 reports against you in 2 years from diverse sources that are not like coordinating to like wage a campaign against you, this new system's going to pick that up. It's going to say, wow, we're getting lots of stuff coming through the funnel about this, and it's going to see it a lot quicker. And it's not going to have to take 10, it's just going to accumulate over time. And then the third reason that I would say, there's others, but the third one, the canons needed to be amended, is that they were too imbalanced. Bishops were treated quite a bit differently than clergy. So the rights of care, accountability, and agency, those four things, rights, care, accountability, and agency, need to be fairly balanced. Everybody needs to have rights. Everybody needs to have care. Everybody needs to have accountability. And everybody needs to have agency. And I think the new canons do a lot better job of doing that. And I'll finish with this analogy. If you play a baseball game and you play really hard, but you still lose, but you can say that the umps did a great job. The umps really, they call that game fair. I lost fair and square. We just, they out, other team outplayed us, or I didn't do a good job, or we didn't play our best game. Then you can walk away knowing you lost, but you still feel good about that loss. If your sense is that there was systemic unfairness in the refereeing of the game, the identifiable systemic unfairness about the refereeing, and you lost, that creates a different dynamic. That wasn't just we got outplayed. There was something in the system that was designed to put the finger on the scale against our team. And if you do that across a whole system, you're going to get results that are not going to be healthy for the church long term.
Yeah. So Title IV needed to be amended. It's been, I think, almost a year now. It went through three or four public requests for feedback. Did you and your team participate in that feedback process at all?
Oh, we did. We participated in rounds 2 and 3, and a number of the recommendations we made were accepted, and the changes were made on the basis of that. And we're very grateful. And obviously, everybody, whoever wanted to, had the opportunity to make their recommendations, and then the GTF considered that. Some of the changes that they made in the new canons, that were very good. There's greater sensitivity to the needs of reporting parties now. Anybody can make a report. There has to be unanimous consent for a report to be dismissed. So that's a high bar. The reports administrator, the bishop ordinary, and the chair of the reports investigation committee have to all agree that this report needs to be dismissed before it can be set aside. If any one of them says, no, we can't dismiss this, it's going to go to the next stage of investigation, before the reports investigation committee. That's a good high bar to make sure. As Canon Rowell says, there's going to be lots of eyeballs on this. And then if there's an accusation of serious misconduct, such as alleging sexual misconduct or abuse in a familial relationship, you can now make a written statement, and there's safeguards there to give an opportunity for sensitive matters to appear in writing. So greater sensitivity to reporting parties. Another thing they did really well, they added greater rights of appeal. And so I compare this to Exodus chapter 18, where Jethro says to Moses, You're going to have the kind of the quarts that are over the 50s, and then over the hundreds, and then over the larger group, and then quote matters that are too difficult, let them come up to Moses. So the assumption there is what I call ascending courts of appeal. If the judge of the group of 50 could let somebody have the right to appeal to the next level, and if that group couldn't handle it, it's the next level. So that the reason that's good is it creates accountability, it creates transparency. If a lot of appeals keep coming from a particular reports investigation committee, at some point somebody's going to look under the hood and say, why does this reports investigation committee keep on having appeals filed against them for their processes? So the rights of appeal create accountability all around. That's a good thing. There's increased interlocking accountability. Again, this is Cannon Rowell's phrase, lots of eyeballs on the process. So you're going to have a reports investigation committee, you're going to have a provincial tribunal, you're going to have a diocesan tribunal. So these are all people looking in on the process. There's also more just reporting requirements now. We've gotten closer to the Episcopal Church canons on what has to be reported publicly versus what's going to be recorded privately, and that's gotten more fine-tuned. And then finally, clergy and bishops, who are typically the ones to be accused, they now have more specific rights of information and response. Those are spelled out in much more detail now. So all those improvements are good all the way around.
So you said earlier they're about 75% of the way there. What is the 25% that you feel like needs more work?
Yeah. So the first one, interestingly enough, was added to the final draft after all feedback had been closed. So that's significant because nobody across the province had a chance to give feedback on the text of this command, this canon. I think the idea was suggested or requested, but in terms of like seeing it in writing and that kind of in its final draft and then giving feedback on that, that did not occur. And that essentially what it does is it makes a reporting party advocate available to what used to be called the complainant or the reporting party now. And that person is a volunteer, but they are tasked with guiding you through the process, helping you understand the process, and they are able to attend meetings with you. They don't have the right to engage or to speak, but they're able to attend with you. And when you look on the other side of the responding party, the respondent, the person who's being accused, there's no such provision for them. They are not offered a responding party advocate. So there's kind of a one-sided thing going on here. One side gets help, the other side doesn't. If you look at the Episcopal Church canons, which interestingly, our canons have gotten more and more like the Episcopal Church as the feedback
It's funny
traffic.
to hear you re refer to anything with regard to the Episcopal Church as sort of the ideal that we should be shooting for.
I
But if they were
encourage,
going to get one thing right, it's probably canon law, right?
yeah, I mean, I'd encourage everybody to go read the Episcopal Church canons, and I'll say it somewhat provocatively. I would rather be accused under the Episcopal Church canons than I would under our canons. Even though our canons are better than what they were, clergy and bishops have more rights under the Episcopal Church canons than they do under ACNA canons. There is a guaranteed right to presumed innocence until proven guilty under the Episcopal Church canons. That does not exist under our canons. The burden of proof is stated in canon law to exist with the church attorney, with the prosecutor, not with the respondent. That's in canon law and the Episcopal Church canons. We do not have that right in ACNA canons. The burden of proof is not guaranteed to be with the church attorney. Episcopal Church canons from the beginning give a guaranteed or extended, if requested, reporting party advisor and a responding party advisor. Both parties are treated equally. Perhaps most significant, if you compare and contrast Episcopal Church canons to ours, is how they define a respondent with how we define a respondent. I'm just going to read this out loud for your listeners because it's that significant, and you can go look it up. This is Title 4 under definitions of the Episcopal Church. It says, respondent shall mean any member of the clergy A, who is the subject of a matter referred for conciliation or to the conference panel, that's who decides what happens with the accusation or the complaint, or to the hearing panel, that's the court, so to speak. B, whose ministry has been restricted, so inhibited in any way, etc. C, who has been placed on administrative leave. D, who is the subject of an investigation and is asked by an investigator or the bishop diocesan to provide information or to make a statement. So, as soon as a complaint is filed against you, you are automatically a respondent in the Episcopal Church canon law. Or E, who agreed with the bishop diocesan regarding the terms of discipline pursuant to Canon 4.9. That would be called a consent order. So basically, from the get-go, you are a respondent. As soon as any action is taken against you, you are a respondent, and you have the rights of a respondent, including an advisor, just as the reporting party has an advisor. Now, in contrast, listen to how our current proposed canon law defines a respondent. Quote, a respondent means any bishop with respect to whom a presentment has been referred to the disciplinary tribunal for a bishop, or any member of the clergy with respect to whom a presentment has been referred to a diocesan court or a tribunal. That's Canon 4.2 definition respondent. In other words, you are accused, but you're not yet a respondent. You are under investigation with canonical or legal action possibly being considered against you, but you are not yet a respondent and you do not have the rights of a respondent. It is not until they decide you're probably guilty and they're going to refer you for presentment that you become a respondent. That is a very, very limited definition of what it means to be a respondent, and it is a significant imbalance in the scale. In fact, we have a member of our vestry who is a 25-year HR, corporate HR leader in a national company that everybody would recognize. And when she saw this provision in the canon law, she was shocked that this would even be the practice. Again, 25 years of experience in corporate America HR leadership. And so that needs to be changed. That's number one. We need a fair, a broader definition of the respondent and the corresponding rights of an advisor to the respondent, just as the reporting party gets. By the way, we would be making the exact same argument if the responding party got an advisor or an advocate and the reporting party did not get an advisor or an advocate. So we're arguing for fairness across the board. We're not arguing for special treatment. The second matter is it gets to the heart of our theology, really, and the nature of the pastoral relationship. And current canon law says the moment a report is filed, the bishop ordinary may not offer pastoral care to anybody associated with the report, which means you're now accused, or you have a report filed against you. You are now under investigation, and your bishop is no longer your pastor and not allowed to be your pastor, regardless of the merits of the accusation. He may and he should and is encouraged in canon and the current proposed canons to appoint an alternative pastor, somebody else to be your pastor. That gets into all kinds of things. Scripturally, the Lord disciplines those he loves. So, should we really, from the gate, divorce discipline and care? It gets to the nature of the pastoral relationship. Are you allowed to talk to your bishop still if you're under accusation? What if the investigation goes on for multiple years, as has happened? How does that relationship work? It gets into what about rectors who have maybe a husband and wife who are accusing each other of wrongdoing? Should that rector recuse himself from caring for both parties until he's adjudicated the matter, perhaps including church discipline, as the 39 articles and our bylaws oftentimes stipulate can happen? And so is this are we looking at the church through a legal lens primarily, or a pastoral, theological, biblical lens primarily? And as one canon lawyer who I talked to put it, there are some biblical tensions that are so important they should be maintained, not abolished through canon law. And what the canons now do is they abolish the tension between care and discipline, They abolished the tension through canon law. The pastoral relationship between the bishop ordinary and an accused clergy is temporarily dissolved until the matter is brought to conclusion. That's radical. That is unprecedented. The Episcopal Church canons do not do that. The Roman Catholic canons do not do that. We are unprecedented, to my knowledge, in taking that step. It's legally tidy. It's got going to have massive consequences, especially for trusts between clergy and bishops. Massive consequences down the road if that plays out.
I can't help but think of when I stand up every year during our Episcopal visit and present our candidates for confirmation and say, Right Reverend Father in God. And to imagine, since I am also a father to children in my own home, and I am called, I think, by scripture and by our Lord to love them and discipline them. Those two things seem to go hand in hand for a father. And if our Episcopal leadership are fathers in God, it does seem like it makes all the sense in the world to ask them to continue to care for us, even as they discipline us.
Yeah, and think of John chapter 8. There was a trial, there was a court scene brought to Jesus. This woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Moses says that we should stone her. What do you say, Jesus? They had the stones ready to go. The stones were in their hand. This was just punishment from their perspective. Jesus didn't say, "Hold on, let me recuse myself. A disciplinary matter has been brought before me. I'm sorry, I can't care for you right now. I need to kind of put on my disciplinary hat." He wore both. He adjudicated the matter and he cared for the woman. He disciplined her, so to speak. Said, "Go and sin no more." That was a gentle rebuke. It was an acknowledgement that she was caught in sin, but he also defended and protected her and cared for her. Paul deals with court scenes in the Corinthian church, and he doesn't recuse himself while he adjudicates the matter. He both cares for the church and he brings discipline. And your example of a parent with a child is a great example. If your child is accused at school of wrongdoing and it's a serious accusation that may or may not be true, do you say, "Hold on, son, hold on, daughter, I need to assign somebody else to care for you while I sit in judgment on this matter, and then I'll become your parent, I'll become your father, I'll become your mother again after the matter has been resolved"? That would cause a lot of confusion for your child and a lot of questions about future trust for your child. So there's a real issue there. We do need impartiality, but there are tools and grounds for maintaining impartiality without using kind of the meat cleaver of saying we're going to temporarily sever the pastoral relationship. That is unprecedented. Biblically, it's unprecedented in church history that I'm aware of and in other denominational traditions. And so, if other traditions have found a way to keep two things that are in tension in balance, why are we taking this unprecedented step of saying, by no flexibility for the bishops at all, that they are categorically, regardless of the merits from the filing of report, categorically not allowed to pastor anybody associated with the report?
So these are your two main issues, right? The imbalance and lack of fairness between complainants and respondents in terms of representation, and when they are called complainants and respondents, and the current inability of bishops ordinary to care for clergy who have just been under their pastoral care, but who are now accused of something. It's very late in the game, as you've acknowledged. What steps are you guys able to take to try to make these changes?
First thing I would say, I'm very grateful for the feedback process. I think the feedback process has been excellent that the GTF has put in place. I think everybody has had a chance to have a fair hearing through that, including us. I think it would be a mistake, however, to say that a feedback process is the same thing as deliberative debate. One group getting to hear the thing and then decide what they want and don't want, the GTF specifically, is not the same thing as having respectful, wise, deliberative debate. And so our hope is, and the case we're making is that these two remaining issues are so consequential for the life of the church, the future health of the church, the future recruiting of clergy of the church, so consequential that they deserve a greater deliberation and debate. Other people can disagree with us, and other people may have their own issues, and we welcome that. We're trying to have the debate. We're not trying to squelch it or say that just kind of just hurry up and vote. Like we're not saying that at all. And so we've written a short essay. Matthew Wilcoxon, our clergy delegate, who's supporting this amendment to explain why we think this is important. We've also shown in writing what we think needs to be the strike through, and then the new text that we think would resolve these matters without upsetting the apple cart. We don't think it would do damage to the overall structure of the GTF's work to say this side has an advocate, let's give this other side an advocate. Let's treat everybody fairly. We don't think that's going to undo the logic or the machinery. And then to give the bishop greater flexibility doesn't mean he can't recuse himself, doesn't mean his impartiality can't be challenged. It can. It just means the bishop needs more flexibility than you are automatically not allowed to pastor anybody. And how does that work practically? Is the bishop allowed to ask how you're doing, or is that now a violation of canon law? Like, is that where this goes? Like, how is that practical? And so there needs to be flexibility there. We're not arguing for like all the case studies. We're just arguing for flexibility to navigate a variety of situations. And so we're looking for 10 delegates. Current rules of order for provincial councils say that 10 delegates can put a matter on the agenda if they request that and present their request in writing to the chair of the executive committee. And so we're actively sharing our thoughts and our proposal with clergy, laity, bishops, anybody who's interested. And we've got a website, amendtitle4.com, with four being the IV Roman numeral four. Amendtitle4.com. People can go read more about this. But we think this is going to be good overall for the health of the church. We think the process is going to be good to have open, respectful dialogue. We're not afraid of that. We actually are encouraged by it. And we want the good of the church. We want the good of the church for laity, for clergy, for bishops. We want the good of the church for complainants or reporting parties, as well as responding parties. We want truth. We want justice all the way around. And so the opportunity before us right now, like this is a multi-decade opportunity. We have the opportunity to do something right now that will bless the church for decades to come, that will be an example to other denominations and other traditions and even non-Christians. Like, wow, they really have set up a good process here. And so we're actually excited about that opportunity. And we want to kind of advocate for that, especially for the bishops as they gather to take a closer look at this. In our experience, people are either asleep, like it's just too much. It's too much legalese. I don't care. Just do whatever you want. They're either asleep or they're tired of it because they've been in the weeds and the details for so long. There's, oh my goodness, I'm so tired. Just pass the thing. And we're saying there's kind of a middle ground between being asleep and not caring and being tired and overwhelmed and just kind of just pass it. Like, no, there's at least two things here that need to be thought through. And let's do this right. And let's do this in a way that everybody can say, I think that's just, and I think that's fair, or at least the vast majority can say this is just and fair. So that's what we're arguing for.
I've seen some people online reacting to Matt's essay, wondering if this is even possible, if it even sort of works legally speaking. So I wonder if you would walk, just to encourage our listener not to give up before they start, how does it actually work practically? So 10 provincial council delegates, they get something on the agenda, an opportunity to speak. What happens then?
Yeah, they have to present that too. And Matt's not available right now, but he's the greater expert on this since he's a delegate. I'm a delegate to provincial assembly, which is not allowed to make amendments. But yeah, if you present that before the meeting is called to order, that's then submitted to the chair of the executive committee. As I understand it, the rules of order are also voted on at the beginning of the meeting. And so there is the opportunity, according to the current rules of order, to put things on the agenda or to put motions forward. Again, if they're submitted in writing in advance by 10 or more delegates, and we're on our way to hitting that number, and we think we will hit that number. And at that point, then lots of things can happen. Somebody can make a motion to table it and try to table no debate, like, no, we're not going to do this. And then that would get put on. Somebody can make a motion to refer it to a committee or to. So there's lots of different things that could happen procedurally and from a parliamentary perspective at that point. But the argument we're making is like this is important enough that we need to kind of slow down just a little bit. We're almost to the finish line. Like, let's do this right. And it's just, I would say it's manifestly unjust to treat one party systemically one way from the beginning and to treat the other party systemically by design a different way from the beginning. That's systemically unjust. So let's do this right and let's celebrate. Like, this has been a lot of work that's gone into this. We want to support these canons. We want them to be the best they can possibly be.
It sounds to me like you're saying you don't even need to slow down all that much. Just take a breath. You have these redlined canons right here for you. Why don't we just send these to provincial assembly rather than these? That's really all you're saying, right?
Yeah, well, everything the GTF has done, like, we're in full support of it. Like,
And
these
you
two
don't want to
changes.
go like for another year of review or more
No.
committees.
No, not at all. Like, we don't think that's necessary. We think we're really close. In fact, the language we propose is taken almost verbatim from the Episcopal Church canon. So it's already been legally vetted. The Episcopal Church's lawyers have already vetted the language of a responding party advisor. And so, like, we're not lawyers. We're just going to say, like, hey, I think they've done this one a little bit more sensibly. I think they're a little bit more fair and balanced than us here. So let's take their good work, and we don't agree with them in everything, but we think they've done something good here. And let's adopt that. Like, let's not reinvent the wheel. Let's not make our lives harder than it needs to be. Let's get across the finish line together. Let's celebrate, and let's get on with the mission of the church in such a way that we're confident in our Title IV disciplinary procedures, that when they need to be put into action, we know the machinery is well designed, it's well crafted, and it's going to treat everybody fairly, and it's going to get to, we trust and pray, a just conclusion. So that's yeah, this isn't, we don't see this as a hard lift. We see this as just we're almost there. Good, like, let's finish the job.
Well, Elijah, thanks so much for your time. Is there anything else you want to say before we wrap up?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the opportunity to share. Appreciate the work the GTF has done on this, and I do pray for our bishops. Like I said, I'm not a delegate to provincial council, so I don't have a voice or a vote. But I care about the church, and I've done enough homework that I think I know a little bit about the nuances of these matters and how the machinery works. And so I want to kind of help wake people up a little bit to the importance of what of this. This is a very important moment, a very hopeful and critical moment in the life of our province. And yeah, just encourage our bishops as well as the lay and the clergy delegates to take these matters seriously. And we think they're worth your deliberation and they're worth your consideration.
And the website is amendtitle4.com, amendtitleiv.com. That's right.
That's correct. Yep.
All right. Well, that's going to be all the time we have for our show today. Thanks for listening to Stand Firm. If you want to keep the conversation going, please be in touch with us. Rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com, or you can join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks so much to Elijah Lovejoy for joining me. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back with Matt and JD next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.